Well, excuse me. Thank you very much, Rhonda, and it's great to be here again for the third year with you and Joe at what is, I think, the number one communities conference in Australia. It's extraordinary the number of people that come and take part in this conference. I'm very pleased to be here with my colleague, Hong Lim, who's the Parliamentary Secretary for Victorian Communities, and also with former Premier Joan Koerner, who's heading up my Ministerial Advisory Committee on Community Building, which a number of people here are involved with in that Ministerial Advisory Committee. I would like to start also by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land where we are here today, the Kulin Nation, and paying my respects to their elders, particularly any elders who are here today. Well, before I start, I should respond to Rhonda on two points. First, in terms of social epidemiology and research, I agree absolutely. I think we do need to have clear evidence put before the public on what works, what's most successful in community building, and how we can learn from that. And certainly our department, the Department for Victorian Communities, is now doing that. And we have got some comparative research where we can see what improvements we're getting as a result of community building across a number of years. And we are seeing things like people feeling safer as when they walk down the streets now, more people being involved in volunteering activities, things like that, which are real measures of community strength we can now begin to track. But I think it is fair to say, Rhonda, that it's at the early stages. Of course, the organisation that is probably the leader in this field in Victoria is the organisation that Rhonda formerly headed up, which is Vic Health. And Vic Health has been certainly very influential in my thinking about health and communities, and we want to build that. Secondly, just respond to Rhonda in relation to our social policy, which we released about a month ago, A Fairer Victoria. And I will talk a bit about that in more detail today. But I would like to start by emphasising that that policy was not a policy that was dreamed up by government. It wasn't a policy that came from a minister or a bureaucracy. It was very much a bottom-up policy, which people like Rhonda and many of the people here today had a key role in formulating. And a number of the practical initiatives in it are initiatives that came from people involved in the community movement. And you know, one area, for example, that Rhonda's obviously very passionate about is giving people with disabilities equal access and a real opportunity to fulfil their abilities. And one example I know Rhonda's pushed and I'm trying to see that is incorporated is that we use access and fair access as one of the criteria when government is handing out contracts. And that's the sort of thing that Rhonda suggested and is now in that Fairer Victoria policy. But what I've been asked to talk about today, and I'll give you the topic because it's an interesting one. Imagine local government and communities locked in a passionate and equal relationship. Now, I have to say, I'm not sure why they asked me to talk about this, but I do have some experience because I actually met my wife through local government. I hope that we're still locked in a passionate and equal relationship. She was on the St Kilda Council, I was on the South Melbourne Council, and that's about, I think, about 18 years ago now. But, it just shows in a very practical way what can happen. But it did get me thinking about private lives and our private lives and really what we can learn from our private lives when we come to think about government. Because often we tend to think of them as so separate, and yet we really ought to be thinking of them as all part of the same thing. I mean, in our private lives, we're very aware that the quality of our intimate relationships, the relationship with our partner, our children, is really what determines how well we feel about ourselves, how satisfied we are, how much self-respect we have, how much ability we have to do what we want to do. And we know that, for example, if the relationship is equal, it's much more likely that we will have that self-respect and that we'll go on and achieve. And we know that if it's passionate, that level of enthusiasm that you get through passion enables you to achieve much more. It enables you to do that little bit extra. And we also know that if our personal relationships are not equal, how that can erode. It has a really eroding effect on the relationship. And people get jealous and dissatisfied and pull out of joint action. And we also know that when we think about our home life and measure it, we measure our home life on the quality of those relationships. Now, that's what you think about when you think of home, how well you're getting on with your partner, your kids, that sort of thing. That's how we think about it. We don't actually measure it by saying, oh, how many chops did we have on the plate at night? Or how many socks did we wash and then put on the washing line? And yet, when we do government, that's exactly what we do. We actually measure government not on the basis of relationships and the quality. We say, how many occasions of service have we delivered this month? You know, how many chops are on the table? And so I think we really have something to learn when we do our public realm from our private about the importance of relationships. And a lot of this has now got bound up in academic theory, and we talk about social capital, and there's all this theory around bridging relationships and all sorts of things. And a lot of people are suspicious about that. Some people say, oh, it's all just academic claptrap. But, you know, that is just common sense. Based on our own private lives, we know that the strength of relationships is absolutely critical. And in a government sense, those relationships, of course, go beyond families to the relationship between neighbours. The relationship between about strangers, how you feel about strangers is critical. If you walk down the street in an area and you see a stranger and your immediate reaction is to turn away and be fearful, that is not going to be a successful community. If on the other hand, you walk down the street and the stranger's there and you say, oh, how are you, and the weather and whatever, you know that's a strong community. And we know it ourselves as we go around the state, those communities where people say hello to strangers are quite different. And I think for government, that's one thing that we're now learning, that increasingly our role is not about directing people or directing organisations, central planning direction, which was sort of the 20th century model. It's more about supporting good relationships at the community level, not directing them, but supporting them, doing what we can to build up strength, to build up good relationships between local government and our government, between a local community organisation and local government, between just people in the street. And so I think that is a new way of doing government. It's a different way, but it's a more successful way. And it's really at the heart of the reason we've set up our new department for Victorian communities. And the other thing that we learn from our private lives is that if you have good, equal relationships, it gets you through the tough times. You do need that to get through difficulties. And it's the same in the public arena. We do know that there are tough times, that for many people in the community, they are sorely disadvantaged. And the best way to overcome that, to reduce that level of disadvantage, is to ensure that we have strong, equal, robust relationships that will enable us to tackle disadvantage. And today I want to talk a little bit about disadvantage and how we all, that's government and the community, can and should be tackling that. As a government, we've certainly invested in our universal services, things like our hospitals and health system, our schools, our police. So we've got more than 5,000 extra teachers, more than 5,000 extra nurses. We are seeing better results in our schools as a result. But we know that despite all of that, there are major areas of disadvantage across the state. And a few figures, I think, demonstrate this. First, there are 150,000 Victorian children who are growing up in a family where no one has a job. I might say this is reflected Australia-wide, and Australia doesn't do very well on that test. Second, and this is also something that's Australia-wide, where Australia doesn't do very well at all, our Indigenous population has a life expectancy 20 years less than the non-Indigenous population. And third, that working age Victorians with a disability have an average income that is about a half of that of people without a disability. So there are three examples, and I could give many more, of quite palpable disadvantage in our community. But we also know that disadvantage can be quite place-based also. And to give a few figures on that, 5% of all our postcodes account for a quarter of all our unemployment. And if you look at life expectancy and death rates, there are quite marked differences of up to 8 years between different postcodes, how long you expect to live. So this can be pretty daunting. These are real challenges and difficulties. But I think for all of us, we have to imagine that through cooperation and action and good relationships, we can reduce that disadvantage. And that is really what has motivated our government in producing the social policy paper that Rhonda talked about, A Fairer Victoria. And at the heart of meeting that disadvantage are community organisations, because they are the organisations that are in the community, that understand it, that have the networks and have the links. And while the topic of my talk today is about imagining a future where we have those good, strong relationships, I think we can say in many parts of the state it is already happening, and we need to build on that. And we don't need to get too depressed about not being able to achieve it. One example, I think, is a great proposal that's come up before us as part of this social policy paper from the Brotherhood of St Lawrence and Frankston City Council. And that is to bring together all the community action and activity that's happening in the Frankston area around a hub, so that instead of the different non-government organisations all doing their own and good things in different places, they bring themselves together. Because it's not only government that has to get coordinated, it's also the non-government sector and community organisations. And so under this proposal, we're putting in $1 million so that we can set up a hub, a building, where the Brotherhood and other community organisations, youth organisations, the local council, other community groups can operate out of and coordinate their activities. And that's just one of the type of strong community actions that is coming out of the community now and is supported by our new social policy, A Fairer Victoria. Now, as we go forward, as well as having those strong relationships, though, we have to have a fairly clear plan, a plan that is developed jointly with the community. And our plan in our social policy has some key aspects to it, and I just want to go through those. The first is that we have to have better access to our universal services. Now, universal services are absolutely critical. They're things like our public schools, our public hospitals. And they are and have to be universal. That is, they have to be available not just to poor people who are poor, but to the whole community. And the reason for that, I think, was described pretty well by Ronald Titmus, the famous English social researcher, who said, if services are just for the poor, they become poor services. Because we all know if anyone in the community can end up in a hospital emergency ward, there's likely to be more lobbying for that to be the best quality than if it's just there for the poorest people in the community. So that's why universal services have to be front and centre of a strong social policy. But we also know that they have to be accessible for people who are most disadvantaged. And unfortunately, that's where we sometimes fall down. So we know, for example, that for Indigenous young kids, Indigenous 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, a very high proportion don't go to kindergarten. Yet we say kindergarten's there for everyone. So we have to do something about that. We know, for example, for people with disabilities, it's actually quite hard to access some of our universal services. So that's the first thing we have to do, make sure that those universal services are truly universal. And the second thing that we have to do, and I must say this was the limb that Rhonda herself specifically put in, and that is that we have to reduce barriers to opportunity. We have to understand that government is not just about providing more services, more chops on the table. It's about understanding that there are real barriers that sometimes are put there by government for people, or barriers that prevent people from achieving their best. And sometimes we have to look at our laws, we have to look at where there's systemic discrimination that discriminates against a whole class of people because it's harder for them to get access to a particular job or a service. And even the fact that in our market economy, where you have to buy everything, if you don't have money, then you miss out. Or in an economy which, in a world which relies so much on the computer and the internet, for example, if you don't have a computer, that's a pretty major barrier for you to get what you need in life. The third area of action in the policy is more support for particularly disadvantaged groups. And we did, in A Fairer Victoria, provide significant extra investment and budget support for some particularly disadvantaged groups, most significantly people with mental illness. People with mental illness in this state, as we know, have not had the support that they need and deserve, and in this policy, we invested $180 million to put extra support for people with mental illness, but also Indigenous Victorians, people with disabilities will receive extra support from that. The fourth area goes back to something I talked a bit about before, which is looking at particular places. And we know, as I said, that particular postcodes in our state are particularly disadvantaged. And that's why, as part of this social policy, we will be investing in particular places, putting more funds, more coordination, working closely with local government and communities to get good outcomes in those places. And we've already had some success, places like the Latrobe Valley, where we had a ministerial task force, and as a result of that, things are really looking up in the Latrobe Valley. But there's extra funds for things like our community capacity building initiative, where smaller towns across the state, particularly around the fringe of Melbourne or in areas that are changing in country Victoria, will get some money to help their community help themselves as part of that community capacity building initiative. And underpinning all of this work, those four things, is the understanding that we need government and communities, that's local, state, federal government and communities, to act much more closely together. And not to see government as something that's done in Canberra or Spring Street, but something that's done at the local level. And to give, I think, the clearest example of how we know this works is the Neighbourhood Renewal Program. This is not just imagining, this is happening around Victoria now. And you can go, and I think many of you here are probably involved in the various programs, but you can go to these neighbourhood renewal programs around the state. These programs have been started up in areas, public housing areas, where the fabric, the infrastructure, the buildings, the streets have, as a result of many years of neglect, become pretty degraded. And that's houses need painting, we need new fences, the streets need fixing up. Now, the traditional way of doing this would have been that the Ministry of Housing would engage a contractor, send the contractors down to paint the places, probably not tell the residents when they were coming. As a local member, I can say this has happened before in my electorate, where the contractors came in and people were still in their pyjamas, didn't know that they were coming. You know, oh, we're here to do up your kitchen. Well, we don't want our kitchen done up. I mean, that was the traditional way. But under neighbourhood renewal, you turn that on its head and the residents decide what they think should happen to their community. They do the planning work. They say how they want their streets, their fences, their houses to look. And not only that, under neighbourhood renewal, the residents themselves do much of the work. So people who've been unemployed, say, can get a job doing the painting, learn skills. And in many cases, that's gone on to that person having a permanent job. Now, I've visited many of these neighbourhood renewal projects, places like Shepparton, Morwell, Wendouree West in Ballarat, Atherton Gardens in Fitzroy. And when you look around, you can really see a difference. But in some ways, it's what you can't see that's most interesting. You see the houses and streets look great, where people will tell you before there were car bodies and in the street and lousy fences, that sort of thing. The streets, the houses look great. But more importantly is the change in community spirit and what's actually going on in that community. And the result of that, we've seen crime come down very significantly. In Shepparton, reported that crime on the estate there had dropped by a half. In Wendouree West, you see the community now talking about a whole lot of new opportunities that they are undertaking, new opportunities for jobs. The community itself has built the playground, the children's playground. Or in Atherton Gardens, you know, a fantastic feeling of community spirit. And once again, crime has gone down. So neighbourhood renewal, I think, is the exemplar of how this type of way of doing government works. And that is, first, it does fix the nuts and bolts. The houses do get fixed, the streets get fixed. But just as importantly, the community itself changes. And there is a sense of pride and respect that means that that community will go on and be more successful into the future. And that's why in our social policy at Fairer Victoria, we're extending neighbourhood renewal. We're putting an extra $30 million into it so that we can go into new areas and continue to expand it in existing areas. And we see the same sort of success in a number of the other community building initiatives. And I could go on all day, I won't, but there are some quite inspiring stories of towns. I mean, towns like in St Arnold, where they established a local theatre because that's what was needed. Or Corryong in northeastern Victoria that set up a welcome kit for new residents. So people, when they came to the town, felt welcome. And just going back to what I talked about earlier about the importance of strangers, you know, how you relate to strangers, that's a great example. Or in Lang Lang, where they took community building very literally and built a community centre that's now got a medical centre in it as well, and a rural transaction centre. So in all of these places, we know that this is really working. We also know that one of the critical factors is volunteers. And last year when I came here, I spoke about volunteers and I announced that we'd be investing some $20 million into programs to support and encourage new volunteering. And since then, I'm really pleased that we've started spending that money and it's working. One of the suggestions that came up was that we ought to have a small grants program for small volunteer groups that encourages those volunteer groups to reach out to people who would not traditionally have been volunteers. You know, because often volunteer groups can be great, but they can be a bit closed and people feel perhaps they can't get in them. But the result of that has been absolutely fabulous. We've had more than 200 grants. I always read the individual stories about each individual grant and often am inspired by what groups are doing. I mean, people like in Boronia, where they're running orientation tours for people from newly arrived ethnic communities to show them around, welcome them into the community. Or the United Cricket Club in Box Hill, which has bought safer canteen equipment that lets intellectually disabled members stay involved in running the club. Now, there are stories right around the state where volunteer groups are now reaching out to other people. And I might say we're also supporting the volunteer resource centres and other centres that are going to encourage volunteering and build it into the future. The final area that I do want to touch on in terms of communities are neighbourhood houses, because neighbourhood houses are the hub of so much great community activity. And one suggestion, once again, I think that Rhonda and others made, that we want to build on, is to see those neighbourhood houses a bit like Ross House in the city, which many of you would know, which is a centre where a range of community organisations can base themselves, get some access to IT and printing and all of those sort of infrastructure needs, but also just by being together, there's an interrelationship between community groups that makes them stronger. And we do want to try to encourage that in neighbourhood houses also. And so there is extra funding for new neighbourhood houses, which we want to set up particularly in disadvantaged areas, with the aim of those places doing all the great things neighbourhood houses do, but also being a place where community groups can set up and share infrastructure and skills and knowledge. And I'm sure many of you are involved in neighbourhood houses, and certainly in future years I see neighbourhood houses as an area that we want to build on and invest in even more. So Rhonda, in conclusion, can I say that our government started this journey of communities a few years ago, about 4 or 5 years ago. There has been real questioning, you know, in the community, within government, about whether it works. As you say, we need the research, but we are getting that research and we are getting the evidence now that it is working. Now, I'm convinced, I was not necessarily convinced myself a few years ago, but I am now convinced that this really works. When you go out to the neighbourhood renewal areas, when you go to the community building initiatives, when you see the palpable difference in people's pride and feelings about their community, you know that you really are onto something here, and we as a government have to get behind it. Thank you.